Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is Willem van der Horst, your host for the show. Let's see, what have we got going on? We've got an exciting show today. I've been catching up with all my publishing schedule, and I was supposed to publish this one yesterday, so I'm running a little bit late, but it's just only a day late, and there's a particular reason I'm mentioning this, actually, because we have an exciting guest, Brian Feaster. Brian Feaster is a web designer, developer, user architect, but that's his day job. And really the reason we're interviewing and having this conversation is because he's also a tabletop role-playing game author, and he's been working on a role-playing game for several years that is finally ready to be put out in Kickstarter. And the Kickstarter just was launched yesterday, and 24 hours later, he just basically completely smashed his original funding goals. So he's going on to the stretch goals right now. Earlier when I looked at this, just before recording, his original goal was to fund the project with $10,000, and he was already at $17,000 or so, and I think he's probably higher by now. I'll double check, but it's still definitely worth checking it out. So he's called his system Open Legend RPG, Open Legend Role-Playing Game, based on the idea of open source, and this is a conversation we have in the podcast. I mean, we had really a lot of fun. We talked about marketing. We talked about the way he marketed his game, the way he marketed role-playing games overall, the way he organized and launched his Kickstarter campaign, such as organizing many of these podcast interviews in advance to make sure that he would have all of these launching at the same time as the campaign would launch. We talk about all the different campaign settings. There's really exciting sounding campaign settings inside of the game system. We talk about the qualities of a game system. What's a game system as well? Which actually makes me think, if you're listening to this and have no idea what a tabletop role-playing game system is, I might have jumped the gun a little bit. So, of course, there's a whole part of the audience, and you guys know what a game system is for tabletop role-playing games, but some others not necessarily. So let me just backtrack slightly if you're new to the show, what the show is about. So I'm a marketer and a tabletop gamer. So more specifically, I'm a brand and marketing strategist. I help brands better communicate with their audience and better understand the media at hand, both from a digital perspective. So everything to do with new technologies and how to use new technologies to communicate with an audience. I'm the head of strategy for a digital agency called Rehab Studio in London, in the UK. And I've also been a gamer for a long time, particularly tabletop role-playing games. And I really enjoy the collaborative storytelling of games like that. And I enjoy a lot of gaming mechanics as well. And this is something I sometimes say when I'm introducing this, but not all the time. And all mammals learn through play. And I've mentioned this in other episodes. And it's something I really enjoy. And human beings, the more complex our language has evolved, the more complex our society has evolved, the more complex our game has been evolving as well. And these days, you look at games and how everybody's playing games from their mobile phone, and there's a resurgence of tabletop gaming and board games. There's over a billion people playing games every day. And it's fascinating. And a lot of interfaces, a lot of our technology, and a lot of our way of thinking, professionals are rethinking this in the perspective of how do we bring a gaming experience to this. So in the podcast, I interview people who work in my line of work in marketing and brand strategy to learn from them, to learn from their inspiration, and also game designers. So Brian is really, really great because he kind of crosses off both. He's worked in marketing, web design, web development, programming, and he is also a role-playing gamer has brought a lot to the table from this particular side of things. So before I keep on rambling like that for way too long, I'd just like to remind you, it'd be awesome if you enjoy the podcast, if you enjoy the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast, don't forget that you can leave a comment or leave a review. You can always tweet at me. I'm on Twitter at HippoWill, or you can go onto the website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. That's everything attached, icecreamforeveryone.net. If you're listening to this through the iTunes podcast app, the basically native podcast app that you get with the iPhone, if you're using an iPhone, then you can leave a review. Or use your computer and go through iTunes and leave a review for the show. It makes a hell of a difference for other people to find the show. And if you leave a review, I'll be reading reviews at the beginning of episodes. I didn't get any new reviews since my last episode, but the last one was published just a few days ago because, as I said earlier, I'm catching up on my publishing schedule. Hopefully, by the time this comes out next week, we'll have a little bit more news on somebody else. And that's about it. So you'll be able to find the links in the show notes. You can just look up on Kickstarter for Open Legend RPG. Very, very exciting project. Without further ado, here's Brian talking about it. Hey, Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Willem.
Absolutely. It's great to have you. It's great that somebody, Callum from the Roliste podcast put us in touch, if I remember correctly, which is brilliant. Yep. And I've been looking into what you've been up to. It looks like you, so as far as I understand, look, you're on a crazy tour right now. You're going on a bunch of different shows and preparing for the launch of your Kickstarter, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I am. It's been a whirlwind, actually, tour. I think you nailed it because it's not even over. I've been on a lot of other shows, and then there's a whole bunch that haven't come out yet that are coming out in the next month or so. Yeah. And yeah, it's all leading up to our October 18th Kickstarter. It was 26th before, but we moved it. But October 18th.
Oh, so you're moving it to October 18th. Okay, cool. So by the time, I mean, we're recording this, so basically this is going to be published just before or as the Kickstarter launches, I think, right?
Yeah, that sounds
great. We'll work out exactly the launch. But the funniest thing is, like, it's the tour, but basically it's the tour that you're mostly doing from your, you know, place of recording at home, I imagine. Right?
I'm lucky. There's a great group that I'm going to go meet in person, a very rare appearance, because they're about an hour away from me. The nerdarchy.com, those guys, I'm going to go and play a game with them in person. So I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, cool. I don't know those guys. So they have is it a live play type of show or?
Yeah, it'll be an interview as well. But there'll also be like I'm going to run them through, an intro, to the Open Legends system in like a game that will be on their YouTube channel. They have a good following. I think like 20,000 people subscribed on YouTube or something like that.
Okay, probably definitely. I mean, I'm pretty sure way more than people listen to this podcast. So,
I mean, who knows?
At some point, I mean, I trust I'll be famous, but in the meantime, it's really good to have you on. And I was excited looking at, you know, your background as I do to prepare for these kinds of conversations, look at a little bit of everything, obviously looking into the Open Legend role-playing game system, but also the fact that, you know, your background's in design and in development, and you might have seen, and for the people who are listening to this, I mean, some of them know, but I usually alternate my conversations between kind of my professional environment, which is typically around design, marketing, communication, strategy, and role-playing games or other types of games as well. So I'm always excited when I talk to a person that's straddling both, a bit like me.
That's really cool. You get bonus points for knowing that. You must have actually, I guess, maybe Googled my name or something, because most people don't.
Too complicated.
Yeah. I'm lucky, right? Because I'm one of the few people who have a name that is not really duplicated. There's not really other Brian Feasters. So I'm easy to find on Google. But yeah, you're right. That's the angle that I come at this from. You're exactly right. I've spent a lot of time in digital agencies, marketing. You know, a lot of my stuff is more on the website, and so I do a lot of web design, web development, marketing for the web, all that kind of stuff. I've been in that for about 10 years now. So, So it's cool. You know, when you look at people who are just starting, there are a lot of people who are making role playing games, and I'm really grateful for my experience, because I think, as you probably would also attest to, it's like a really helpful experience to have when you're trying to do this kind of thing. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to go, and I wouldn't be surprised if that might be an interesting opening to talk about the system a little bit, but we will throughout, and we'll jump around. But
sure.
The idea being that I really like that gaming helps me work in my job and in design, because it's like a different frame of mind. There's different ways of looking at design, different ways of interacting with people. And and I like to find inspiration in sources that are kind of not obvious. Like, usually if you listen to the same things about the same people, you're not learning anything new. So just like I don't learn anything new in advertising by listening to people who work in advertising, usually have to go outside that field. And I guess the idea here, or a question for you might be like, what are the kind of areas that you went to look for inspiration to create your system?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I'll say, and this is something that I kind of repeat from time to time. I think my programming background lends a lot to the game, actually. So when you talk about design, and you know, programming is a different kind of design.
Yeah.
But you know, that background I think has had a really big impact on the game, because that's where the streamlined aspect really comes from. Because when I look at and I see, you know, a lot of games that have X number of different character classes, and then it's like each one is its own little world with totally different rules. Mm. And it's like a whole new learning curve. You know, if you're playing this class in a certain system versus that class. Now, there are other games that do a more classless approach, like Open Legend does. But for me, that was a big part of my inspiration, was like, you know, when I look at the spell lists in like, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, for example, that's just something that always frustrated me, that you have to spend all this time re-referencing over and over this long list of spells. And then when you go to choose your spells for your wizard, it takes hours for me, because I get like decision paralysis, where it's like, well, is this one a tenth of a percent better than this one? And then you obsess over that decision. And I'm literally just paging back and forth, flipping between two different pages.
That reminds me of all my initial experiences. And I'm sure anybody who plays role-playing games knows the experience of like flipping through pages to look at options and creating characters, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted.
Oh, no. In programming, we have a concept called like object-oriented design.
Yeah.
And that says that, like, you know, a given part of a system should do one thing and do that thing really well.
Okay.
Instead of trying to like do everything all at the same time, or sort of have really different. It's like, if you want to do damage, you know, we don't need 50 different spells or 5,000 different spells that do damage. It's just like, what's the measure? You know, what's the scale from lowest to highest, right? And that's how Open Legend works. If you've read any of the rules,
I did start reading the rules, and just so you know, just to make sure that we keep things in context. While I'm always happy to go into details, and I'm particularly interested in this one because I haven't had like that many conversations going to explaining systems, because a lot of the people that listen to this, as we've talked about, are straddling both worlds or coming from communications, and they don't necessarily like know hardcore role-playing game lingo. Just to make sure we explain things as we go. And it's actually quite cool, because then, you know, I'm just starting the second season and getting back into it after a summer break. And I've had great feedback from people from the other side, like in communications, or anybody other that comes across the podcast and don't know about gaming, and actually find that that's where they're learning the most, or then they're really enjoying the conversations as well. So, I mean, anybody that I'm like, you know, communicating and getting to find out about role playing games in general is always a great experience. I'm always happy to do that. So
that's cool. Well, keep me honest and let me know if I ever if I get deep into using, because I sometimes I'm not aware and self aware enough to know.
Yeah, of course,
it's
fine. It's totally fine. So where I was going to pick up on the if we go back to the top and explaining what it is. And. And it was great that you talked about the comparison with programming, which is super interesting. I find the object-oriented design and technology super interesting on paring things down to the simplicity, which is the streamlining that you're talking about. Right. And the other aspect that I thought was interesting and worth talking about is in the name. So the system that you've created is Open Legend, right? And you're calling it an open source role-playing game. So I thought it'd be interesting to come back also to what open source is. And for anybody who doesn't know, even who, like, there's role players who might not know where open source comes from, and like, how do you qualify the idea or movement of open source in general? Where does it come from?
That's a great question. That comes from my day job too. So as a programmer, what a lot of people don't know is huge amounts of complex technology that people interact with every day actually comes from the open source community. And the open source is a reference to the fact that, you know, it's possible when writing code to compile that code and to make it essentially make the end result non-readable, right? And so when the end result of the code is non-readable, it's not, or not human readable anyway, only machine readable, then, you know, that's a way of protecting the code so that it doesn't get stolen or borrowed by somebody else. And, everything that you interact with all the time, you know, 70% of the websites in the whole world are built on WordPress, and WordPress is an open source blogging platform, right? So they share this code, and because it's open source, that means that other people can come along and contribute and add to it, right? So I'm borrowing that concept, which is that I'm not trying to hide the content of the game behind a brick wall or like a paywall where people have to pay to access it. Because for me, I really believe that the best possible thing that can happen for the game, for Open Legend, the game, is for the maximum possible number of people to play the game. And so as a result, we are going to have stuff that you pay for, like a hardcover book. Obviously, it doesn't make sense for me to give that away for free, but the actual introduction to the rules and the game itself is right there on the website, and it's for anybody. So, you know, if you're I always say this, but like, you know, if you're very young, if you're a kid who's 10 years old but wants to play role playing games and doesn't have anybody else to play them with, you know, you can use things like Roll20 to meet other people, you know, online and play. And then you can also, you know, use a game like Open Legend where, you know, if you don't have any allowance money and you can't afford to buy a book, then you can get started on role playing games at a young age. And for me, that's just like real important to me. I want people, like even young people, that's part of it. And then the other part is just that I just figure the more people that play it, the better the game will be, because the more, you know, feedback we'll have and the more community we'll have. So that's what it means for the game. But then in programming, it goes a whole step further. You know, you have, you'll have entire, like large amounts of prestige will be associated with certain open source projects, because some of them are used by millions and millions of other developers. And you actually, you have like celebrity status. There are certain developers in the programming community who, they actually get sponsored by very large organizations because of their open source contributions. They don't even build like a product directly. They just build open source technology that is consumed by many, many commercial organizations and stuff like that.
So, so part of the creds that you build is if whatever you're building is used by a lot of other developers and programmers.
Yeah, that's, and exactly. And that's my goal with Open Legend, right? I want other people to build on top of it, to add their own content, add, you know, different campaign settings and adventures and stuff like that. So that's my hope. That's my dream with it anyway.
So if we go a little bit on, again, like we keep explaining a little bit, like, you know, just well for everyone, but in particular for the people who don't know so much about it, how do you usually explain what a role-playing game is? But in this context, particularly for Open Legend, what a system is and how do you approach creating a system for a role-playing game? Because I think a lot of people now know what a role-playing game is, but yeah, so how would you explain that part?
How would I explain what a role-playing game is? I think those of us who have played role-playing games a lot, most, I think many of us have a kind of like a default script that we've settled on for how we explain it to people. And mine personally is, I say it's like a play without a script. You know, that's kind of how I explain role-playing games. It's like, and instead of a script, we have rules that test whether or not something is possible. So that replaces the writing because it's not premeditated. So it's like improv theater where you don't know ahead of time what's going to happen, except you add into it, you know, of course, the other element, which is that it's also a game where you don't, there's not a win or lose in the traditional sense, of course, as we, as those of us who play know, but there is, you know, ups and downs, like you successfully conquer an obstacle or you don't, right? And that's determined by the rules and the mechanics of the game.
And so essentially Open Legend is role-playing game, a system. So all the rules that you're just mentioning, so it's the rules without necessarily the background and the setting. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the base of it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's something that's different about Open Legend, the game itself. For those who are unfamiliar with role-playing games, a lot of them will And especially, I think nowadays, it's a big trend to see a real close relationship between the story and the rules itself. And Open Legend is in that way a kind of opposite of the trend, because Open Legend really wants to just give you a vessel that rules, that mechanical vessel to tell any story. And so when I started this, writing this like 5 years ago, the thing that that was the spark or my inspiration for it was the simple sentence, like, I want a role playing game that can be the engine that powers any story in that you see in a book or a movie.
Yeah.
Right. And so for me, a lot of other games, because of their really close relationship between the rules and the story, like, you can't really do that because you're limited to telling one really specific type of story.
Yeah.
And so with Open Legend, that's the other place where the open word in the title comes from, is it's open in genre. So I have people working on like a Star Wars, like space opera version. You know, I have people working on a post-apocalyptic future where people think that technology is actually magic. They don't know that it's technology. You know, somebody who's writing a thing that's like London 1800 superheroes, kind of a campaign setting. So there's like, I could go on, but
No, we'll definitely come back to that. Brilliant. No, but it's a very good explanation. And one side note as well, just because you mentioned it, just making sure that we don't step over it. You mentioned Roll 20 as an interface for people to play. Just for everybody to know, so Roll 20 is a video software for people to play a role-playing game via computer. So you have a lot of help to roll dice and have maps and different things like that. Yeah, that's right. Right. I didn't forget anything.
That's correct. I would just add that it's if you want to check it out yourself, it's a free, you can sign up for free, and it's roll20.net.
So let's backtrack a little bit. How did you get into role playing games in the first place? Like,
oh, that's a great question. How did I get into role playing? You know, I remember my first group, but I'm straining to remember like my first interaction with like the rule. Cause we all kind of,
how old were you those of us around then?
That was when I was like 12 or 13.
Yeah.
So that was about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I think I feel like I probably saw this really cool looking cover with his fantasy art in the bookstore for like a year or two before I ever interacted with it or anything. And then, you know, eventually I bought the book and Dungeons and Dragons second edition in mid-90s or whatever. And and then I had a neighbor who lived a little ways down the road who it was a funny story. Most people play with people their own age, but in my case, I actually was 12 or 13, and the youngest other person in my first group was like 20, 21, 22, something like that. Yeah, so it's an unusual circumstance. But
Were you the one that like found the game and introduced it? So like mastering the game, or
no? I found the rules, and I was really looking to get involved, and then I happened to Basically, the guy who I was playing with, his age was different enough that I wouldn't really run into him in school. But his father and my father worked together, so that's how we met.
All right, cool. And were you already? So where is this, by the way?
Where did I grow? I grew up mostly in New Jersey in the U.S.
Okay, cool.
And I currently live in Delaware. So I've lived in Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey, and Delaware, different parts of my life. But I'm in Delaware now. It's only like an hour and a half from where I grew up, actually.
So. I do. I have not been to Delaware, but one day I really, really want to come to check out the Dogfish Head Brewery because it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes you wonder, like, if you are from there, do you still like it as much? I love Dogfish Head. I drink it a lot, actually. So I don't blame you. You'll have to stop by.
Yeah. All right, cool. So you found out about that. You started playing Dungeons and Dragons, obviously, like, you know, seminal classic. And and after that, like, how did you develop? What kind of games were you into? Did you stay on the traditional fantasy or...
Over the years, I did a couple different things in other genres and in a couple different systems. But I would say my personal background is kind of for games is kind of, I don't know, 95% D&D or something like that. In 1999, I ran a game with people who were my other friends, you know, not my gamer friends, but my same age high school friends.
Right.
And at that time, Wizards had or it was TSR, I think, at that time had released a game called Alternity, which was about like modern times or sort of near future or whatever.
Yeah.
And we did a funny storyline where, because it was 1999, I ran a scenario where all of my friends, to make it easy to enter the game, I actually had them play themselves.
Okay.
So they were playing themselves, and it was a post-apocalyptic story where all of these aliens started, or like demons started coming out of the sea, and they were taking over like the country. And so they went and they broke into the local like gun store and all this stuff. And it was funny because they were playing themselves for real.
That's
and
funny.
It was an interesting
hanging out of the like meta thing going on.
Yeah, it was funny.
And did you tend to like play like the same characters and same stories over very long campaign periods or a bit of everything or?
Yeah, well, the meat of my D&D experience was like when I actually moved here to Delaware. Mm-hmm. That was when I was 16 years old. And so I played with the same group for about 16 years. And during that course, we would, me and my other good friend, Peter Fitzpatrick, he actually, we alternated. So we would each run a campaign on 1 week.
Yeah.
We played together every week. And then it would be my game 1 week, my storyline 1 week, and then his storyline the next week. And so that was really great. For anyone who, if you can ever manage it, I know sometimes it's hard to find people, but for anyone listening who's interested in gaming, I found that to be a kind of secret to success in my own experience was that it prevents burnout when you have people rotating.
Yeah.
And so we did this for many, many years, and it allowed me to do a lot of exploring as a player and then a lot of exploring as a GM as well. And to your point, most of our campaigns would run like, I don't know, you know, some short ones would be as short as a year, but typically they were like 3 or 4 years, I guess, on average for each campaign. And so like I've probably, you know, over in the last 20 years, I've probably built and some people run pre-written worlds, but I always like to write my own stuff. So okay. I've probably written 9 or 10 like worlds from nothing since the time I was young and until now or whatever. So that's
awesome. That's really cool. Very cool. And so as you started as a teenager, like, by the way, but when you found out about it, were you already into, I don't know, like fantasy genre books or comic books?
I think I started in fantasy with a book called Dealing with Dragons when I was in second grade.
I don't think I heard of that.
And I don't know if it's I don't think that the book itself is you know, particularly popular or anything like that. You know what I mean? That's just what I happened to read. Now, that was in second grade. I don't remember what I did between them, but then in fifth grade, I read The Hobbit.
Yeah.
This happened when I'm 12 or 13. So this is another, whatever that is, years later or something like that. So.
Cool. Brilliant. And do you tend to play, because like people play in different styles, right? Like, you know, you have people that are focusing on the, like really the details of like killing the dragons and going through like raiding parties and organizing everything in finicky details. I'm exaggerating, but something along those lines, the simulation type games, right? Or more focused on the storyline and adventuring. Well, there's adventuring in every kind of time. You see what I mean? Like some tend to focus more on the narrative and the story. Some tend to focus more on actions, dice, throwing dice, etc. And like, you know, there's all sorts of other styles in between. So I don't know how would you call your style?
I think Open Legend, the game, kind of reflects the fact that I'm really in both camps pretty much on that. I would say I'm more in the story camp than I am in the strategy camp.
Yeah.
Like I'm a little bit more focused on storyline. I'm one of the rare players, I guess, who like, I don't have any problem if we go a session or two with zero combat or anything like that in a game. I enjoy that most. And, you know, and in the groups that I've played with over the years, you know, different character, you know, different faces come and go at the table, different people, and that kind of swings things in different directions in terms of, you know, more people, you know, the more people that feel a certain way, the more the game, you know, pulls that direction. But for me, yeah, story is my favorite part more so than like the mechanics and the fight combat and fighting and stuff like that. Some of my favorite memories from games are, well, really by far my favorite campaign ever. Everyone in the party played a noble, and we were all brothers and sisters.
Okay.
And we basically, our father was mysteriously murdered, or it was supposedly an accident, right? And so my character kind of was the oldest. He returned as like the prodigal son, you know, came back, and he was like this very anti-establishment sort of kind of like I was a sorcerer and a mind mage, but I was like I was all about using the powers of magic to help people basically chill out. So I was like, but anyway, what I did was I had this like, this was third edition D&D. Uh-huh. And so there were these rules for, I had this special ability called like a vow of peace. So if other people didn't hurt me, then my magic was like, or if I didn't hurt them, then my magic was powerful over their minds and stuff like that. But anyway, it was a really cool story because, you know, my character ended up going to the Feylands and married some Fey princess and brought her back and like all this other, rescued her, all that kind of classic fantasy stuff.
Yeah.
But it was my favorite part was the interaction between the characters, you know, where you have like the one brother who was like a slacker and the other brother who everybody kind of picked on and made fun of him. And at the end of the storyline, he was actually the arch villain. He was turned by the bad guys because we sort of like picked on him too much and he became evil. And it was a great storyline. I loved it.
Brilliant. Excellent. That sounds like a lot of fun. And so you're still like, this is all, when were you playing that game? Was it a long time ago or?
Yeah, I mean, now it was probably 10 years ago, maybe eight years, something like that.
So you'd already started your career by then, more or less, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, so if I understand correctly, like your first career was, you started out in design, is that?
Yeah.
Out of your studies, let's just go back one step. What did you decide to study in college?
In college, I studied philosophy.
Yeah.
And so I was majoring in philosophy and on track to spend 12 years of my life, you know, working toward a doctorate in philosophy. And
oh, wow.
I was not anywhere near that track. I shouldn't insult people who are on that track because I only, I never actually graduated from college. I finished 3 years and then, actually, I met my wife who at the time had health troubles and I took over a fitness consulting company. That was my very first gig. And that actually was a cool gig because it gave me enough time, where I had free time. And in that free time, that's where I taught myself design and programming. And, you know, so that was about 10 years ago that I started learning design and programming. I started practicing it professionally and stuff.
How did you get into that? What gave you the idea? Or
we had a friend who needed a website, and for some reason, I guess when I was in high school or something like that, I made a GeoCities website, you know, or something like back in the 90s. And yeah, and it was funny because, you know, I don't remember exactly where I was or what website I was on, but you know, this is 10 years ago or whatever. And I realized that you could right click on a website and then hit inspect as it is now. And then you can look at all the code. And I was like, it blew my mind. I thought, wow, this is amazing. You mean everything that makes up this website is right here? So I'm a very experiential learner. That's why I didn't do well with college. I mean, I got good grades in college, but yeah. I just didn't like it because it's not my style of
Honestly,
learning.
I was like that as well. So I studied in Paris University. Yeah. I studied cinema, but I don't know how it is in the States. I had an impression in the States it was probably slightly more practical, but I don't mm-hmm. know. But Paris mm-hmm. is extremely academic, extremely theoretical. Yeah. Most of the classes are like amphitheaters and it's, you know, monotonous. It doesn't work for me, basically. I'm a bit the same thing. I learn when I'm doing things. Or, I mean, I love reading as well, but yeah.
So. Yeah. So that was, I mean, I didn't get along too well with like the very formal academic type of education. So that's kind of, but yeah, so I taught myself because I realized that you could look at all the code just by right clicking on any website. So I started taking code that was on websites and I would change it around and see like, oh wow, this is amazing. If I make this little change, then it looks different. And so that's how I started learning HTML and CSS, back when I was first started 10 years ago. And, and then we had a friend, who, you know, was, very good. She was a performing artist and, but she was young enough that she didn't really have money to buy or to hire somebody to do a website for her. But I thought, man, this person's a really good artist and, I really want to see them succeed. And so I decided to just, make a website for that person. And, I did that. And that was my crash course. And then, her teacher came to me looking for a website. And so the second website I ever did, I charged for and I got paid for it and, kind of never looked back after that. I had this period in my early career where I did like a huge percentage of the performing artists in New York City have websites that I did back, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, not, I guess I shouldn't say it like that. I mean, Middle Eastern dancing for anyone who knows in that niche, which is much smaller than the overall performing artist niche. In that niche, you could probably still ask people today, most people, if they know my name, and they would, because I just did so many websites for that group of people.
That's and interesting. yeah. Like they do say increasingly that is the right way to approach any kind of business is to find yourself a niche, and then little by little you get known within a particular community, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that I tell people that all the time. You know, for people who are listening, I guess if your audience is people that are interested in starting their own business and stuff like that. Yeah, I tell people that all the time. It doesn't take anything to just go out there, do something once for free and then charge for it the second time. It was hard for me in the beginning because, you know, you put an incredible amount of pressure on yourself when you say, I'm going to charge for this. Now you want to deliver something.
Yeah.
But that pressure is what molded and made me into a professional in the industry, you know, and I don't regret it at all. It is stressful, but it was a way better way for me of learning than doing it in a theoretical way in the university. It was a small niche and it was a fun little ride because I had, you know, like all kinds of people. By the end of it, I was doing websites for people who were literally traveling to a different country every single weekend of the year because they were international, performing artist stars and stuff like that. So,
cool.
But at that time I made a jump to, you know, working for larger companies and got paid more than I was getting paid as a freelancer and stuff like that.
And also another thing I saw when I was like, just kind of browsing around your sites and your LinkedIn profile, we were talking about developer creds earlier. And I think you also, and I don't know at what point, if it's later or that stage, that you developed a couple of WordPress plugins that got, you know, quite a few downloads as well.
Yeah. There's a company called Timely. I hate to be recorded saying anything bad, but to be honest, I think that they've kind of
We don't have to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, no, I guess it's like they had really great goals, and I was really attracted to their vision, which was they wanted to create like a central hub, because right now we have events on Facebook, events on 500 different platforms. And so they wanted to kind of create a way of consolidating events and also a way of discovering events so that, you know, maybe you could go to any city and you could find out about events that are happening nearby.
A lot of people have been trying to do that in startups. Yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, their approach was interesting because I had a lot of WordPress experience as a developer. I built like whatever 30, 40 WordPress websites from the ground up from nothing, not from other templates. I made the templates that, right, you know, that were custom. But anyway, that was, so when we talked, it was cool because they had an interesting plan, which was small venues that a lot of times use WordPress. They can use the plugin, and their goal was to basically farm that data with permission from those, because hey, why not promote that event to some larger network for free or whatever? You know, so that was kind of their business model. Unfortunately, WordPress, it's actually not the company's fault. But I don't think that it's a good idea to build that on WordPress, which is unfortunate because yeah, 70% of websites out there are built on WordPress. So you have a good user base and you have a great chance of catching people and catching events that way. But the code base itself, because of WordPress, ended up becoming cumbersome over time. So now I'm speaking about programming technical stuff, but anyway, it became a little bit cluttered and bloated over time. Yeah. And so I think it kind of collapsed itself accidentally, like as a result. And that happens a lot with technical projects. I mean, I do more of coding and less of design nowadays. Right. So that's the kind of problems that I spend time thinking about and helping with and stuff like that. Yeah. So
let's recenter a little bit. All right. So from designing and developing websites and online applications to Open Legend. So you said earlier you started that 5 years ago. How did that, I guess, how did that get started? And in the past 5 years, where are you getting now that you're about to launch the Kickstarter campaign? What's all the content? Vast multiple questions, which is usually not the way to do this, but you know, we'll do one at a time.
So question number one is like, how did I get started on it 5 years ago? Is that
Let's go with that one. I'm a bit tired.
That's okay. So I guess what happened was this really the inspiration for Open Legend came when I was playing fourth edition, and a lot of other people, I think I got frustrated with that particular edition of Dungeons and Dragons, and things became a little bit less sort of imaginative. Things felt a little bit more restrictive in terms of like your options and stuff like that in the game. And I got frustrated with it at that point because I was like, man, I just thought I know there's an amazing team of people that are building these products, and I love these, and I love Dungeons and Dragons and still do. But I thought, man, from a programmer's perspective, right, it's like this is not streamlined. You know what I mean? And I think it could be. We don't need to have, you know, like I've said earlier, 500 different, 5,000 different spells just with some really minor little teeny differences in the wording and stuff like that. And so I got frustrated with it, and I started, you know, writing my own thing. And I mean, that's kind of how, you know, that along with my idea of I want an engine that can power any story, right? Those are my two, that's kind of my impetus, you know, 5 years ago or whatever, when I first started writing it. So yeah, so I wrote something initially. The dice mechanic, which I think is a fairly memorable because you have lots of other games that have dice pools, and there are other games that have exploding dice. These are two things that are unique about Open Legend. Well, not unique. I mean, things that are particular to Open Legend. But the way that it works in particular, which is that you add dice, but you're still just looking to keep like the highest, you know, small number, you know, which increases your chance that it'll roll the highest number, and if it does, then you'll re-roll. So that's what exploding dice are.
Yeah.
So that part is fairly old. Like, I had that in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. The concept of adding extra dice to the dice pool and stuff it came along shortly thereafter. And then, you know, I play tested it with some of the people in my, you know, local people in my group and stuff like that, my gaming group. And, you know, overall they liked it. I think the problem was just that, you know, it just felt incomplete because the Banes, Boons, and Feats, which are kind of the bread and butter of the game outside of the core mechanic itself, they were just very scarce and it was early phases and stuff. So then I kind of took, I actually took a long time. The game would, if I did it again from start to finish, it does not need to take 5 years. There was time in there, yeah, when sure. I was just kind of, you know, mulling over things and stuff like that. I don't want people to feel like, oh my goodness, this must be so, you know, complicated because it took him 5 years to write it. That's just, you know,
no, of course.
Personal life.
Yeah.
And sorry, stuff. Go ahead. Oh, no, but anyway, and then like 2 years ago, or well, 18 months ago, I kind of went more public with it, and I started a regular campaign. I stopped running Dungeons and Dragons, and I started running just my game, just Open Legend, and I used that as a way to build it while I was running the campaign. So,
cool. And the Kickstarter that you're about to launch, then, is it? So what are the main constituent parts of the project? What's happening on the Kickstarter for this part?
Yeah, so actually in connection with what I just said last, so first off, we have the core rules. So it'll be the first physical printing of the core rules of the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And then in order to add interest to it, because like I said, it's meant to have many stories attached to one like core engine.
Yeah.
As a result, I wanted to have an initial launch that included one of those stories so that people have something to play with and an example to see how the game can be run, and that sort of thing. So the companion for it will be a campaign setting called Amoria's Dawn. And I just mentioned my inner circle of developers that I did for like the last year and a half or so. So the world that I built there is Amoria's Dawn. So I've been developing this for like 2 years or so. And that's the core that's the companion for the core rules. And then, of course, you know, very excited because while I've built out the core, I've hired a whole bunch of different writers to come on and offer their expertise and sort of add a lot more detail and, you know, new stuff that was not part of the original campaign setting that's come in. And so I have Matthew Mercer, who's the GM from Critical Role, which is on, you know, Geek and Sundry.
Yeah.
And then Ed Greenwood, who is the creator of Forgotten Realms.
Awesome.
Also John Wick.
Yeah.
He's going to do some airship pirates that are part of the campaign because it's a steampunk mashup with like a savage jungle world colliding with a steampunk world. And so there's, you know, so among other things, there's some airship pirates and there's a dragon that Matt Mercer is working on. And there's Schlechtenberg is this gigantic megalopolis city that's 100 miles wide and has like 5 different tiers. And Ed Greenwood's doing the writing for that.
Super exciting. And with that, so all these, that's exciting to have all these other authors on board to bring the system to life, essentially, right? In addition to Amoria's Dawn, is it, right?
Yeah.
Which is a fantasy setting, I guess, or?
Yeah, so it's a mixture between, there's even a kind of almost futuristic sci-fi aspect with, there's one elven tribe or house, as we call them in the setting, where they kind of skipped over the Industrial Revolution and they went to like advanced genetics, but they have an innate sense of modifying genetics and stuff like that. So they're these kind of mutant bio engineers or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, so that part is a little sci-fi. Then you have the home world, which is steampunk, has guns and airships and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And then you have the other tribes, the other elven houses. They're very high fantasy, with a lot of influence from a kind of savage jungle feel, because the whole world is just this verdant. The known world is just this super, super dense jungle.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of So high fantasy mixed with steampunk mixed with it's been cool. Like in on Encounter Roleplay, every Sunday I run a game there, and an open legend game, and I've been doing that for a while now, like 4 or 5 months or something. One game there, somebody played a character that was like a big game hunter. And so he's from the steampunk world, so he had like this bionic eye that can like see in the dark and stuff like that. So he's like this real badass hunter with but cool. It's cool. So people can draw on high fantasy influences if they want to be from Schlechtenberg, because it encompasses, it's meant to be a well of infinite depth, because it's consumed all these other like cultures in its like progress as it sort of marches and conquers. So you can definitely be an elf or a halfling or a wizard, something more traditional fantasy. You don't have to be steampunk, but then that's just an option there too, because like everything kind of lives in that same space, because it's just cool. It's like New York City, right? You can find anything there, you know. Yeah. So.
And are you planning on, with the final kind of product or result, be one book with multiple settings inside, or multiple books or PDFs, or what's the idea?
So the core rule, the Kickstarter, when it launches, you can buy just the Armoria's Dawn campaign setting if you want. And you can also buy just the core rules. It's just that they're two separate, pledge levels in the campaign setting. And they're two totally separate books. Okay. And what we'll do is in the future, we'll be publishing campaign settings that kind of serve as an example for how you might do this genre or that, whether it's like a Deadlands style Weird West campaign or a space opera or, modern like cyberpunk or something. We'll be releasing new settings, as we go along, and, we'll see how things go.
Yeah,
I'm not sure whether I will. I'm very attached to the idea of creating like brand new content. Mm-hmm. I really like that idea. The game is cool because it can tell any story. So maybe I'll wind up in a situation where I do, license some other kind of intellectual property for some existing story that's popular. Like, I don't know. I'm not decided on that yet. But for now, I'm real interested in just taking and creating lots of content for many different stories to sort of use, so that there's kind of this one umbrella and it works well, and you can kind of go back and forth between different genres and story types. I find that incredibly compelling. I hope that other people will too. We'll find out.
Absolutely. And to bring it, so I'll obviously add the link in the show notes, but basically anybody going to Kickstarter can just like, whenever it's launched, by the time it's launched, it'll be Open Legend. You can just type in Open Legend RPG and find the project, presumably, right?
Yeah, openlegendrpg.com. At the time of recording, it's not there, but by the time this airs, it will be. I'm going to have a big banner, of course, advertising the Kickstarter.
Sure. And this is interesting because it brings it back to my kind of area of marketing, but it sounds like you're doing some serious preparation for this launch. So how did you organize everything for the Kickstarter launch?
That's a great question. Can you qualify that statement a little bit more? What do you mean by that exactly?
So where did you start to prepare? Where did you start to prepare the Kickstarter?
Okay.
It's open. It's an open question, really. So
So for me,
you had everything written. All your stuff is mostly written or almost, right?
So, I started by going, so I can only tell my story. It's not going to work for a lot of other, because, a lot of people are not going to have an open source game that they give away for free. Sure. But for me, I went public with what I call public beta with the game back in February, beginning of February. And I just put it out there, started talking it up on Reddit. Got on Twitter, started following people on Twitter, talking to people on Twitter. For anyone who's in the game industry, little tip for someone who wants to make their own game. the game industry is small enough that a lot of people who are working in it are, you know, in a circle of people on Facebook. So that you can meet a lot of people that are, you know, game industry, role-playing game industry professionals there. So I met a lot of people there, and got into some different, you know.
And usually pretty accessible as well. I mean, that's also how, I mean, I yep. contact people for the podcast as well. And a lot of people exactly. are very accessible. It's not, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll get, you know, you'll get a lot of people who are, you know, super, super inundated by lots of people because they're more well known, and you don't necessarily, you know, sort of hear back from them. But, you know, I've had good luck, and I believe that's because of my design background really helped, because when you send people, you know, your pitch and try to get them involved, and, you know, one thing is like try to, this is a mistake that I made a lot, is sort of trying to approach people without enough context. It doesn't matter how painful it is from a marketing perspective. It can be really hard to create context so that people have a meaningful and valuable reason to respond or interact with you. Yes. That can be really hard to do, but it's worth racking your brain to do it, because you know, there are a lot of times when I contact people, never heard back. And it's like, you know, once you do that, you are seen as a spammer. You know what I mean? I'm just going to be honest with people. You know what I mean? So I wish that I had done a better job in that regard. But, you know, it worked out well for me. And I think that because I designed, I feel like I did a fairly good job on designing the website, like the presentational aspect of the content for Open Legend. So, you know, when people saw the link and saw what I was doing, it does not look, I think it doesn't look amateurish. And as a result, I think that's why a lot of people were, you know, willing to give it a second thought and listen. And so, you know, in terms of preparing and from a marketing standpoint, I think, yeah, you want to have a professional appearance, you know, first before you start interacting with people. I think that's good. It's a much more uphill battle, I'll say, to get people on board and to sort of believe in and back your project. You know, people who have their own following and can help you with their following. I think if you don't have something that looks professional, you know, you don't really stand too much chance.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to extend your reputation by associating it with something you don't really believe in. So
exactly.
So doing all the work, as you pointed out, correctly, not only preparing things to a certain level so that they can be taken seriously, and also that you're proud of whatever you're sending out, and also being very clear what you're asking the person to do, particularly somebody who's busy or who's in high demand. So preparing something that both looks good and is clear, or like if there's an ask, like what the ask is quite clearly.
That's one thing that I did early on, is also just to throw it out there, this is specific to game design, but you know, I had my rules, and I have a good friend who I've gamed with for 20 years. He's a college English professor, and he took and completely gutted what I wrote and basically almost started from scratch. It's the same in terms of the content, the actual rules and the mechanics and stuff like that. But he almost took it to a clean slate and just rewrote it. So I am hugely indebted to him. His name's Ish Stavos. So, you know, just to give credit where it's due. But so we had marketing content before we started approaching people. We made sure that the language on the homepage was tight, that it tells a clear story. Yeah. It doesn't meander. It doesn't sort of, ramble or whatever. And so that was an early stage thing. We did that. That was the first thing that happened. I went public in early February, got some hype and some talk on Reddit and different stuff like that. And as soon as I did it, like probably within a week or two or less, I talked to Ish and I asked him, and he basically went and started gutting the content immediately. Yeah. So anyone who saw the game, way, way, way back in February, you're going to see totally different content than what we have now.
That's cool. And the other thing is time as well, because a lot of people don't realize that it really takes a lot of time. You know, we're not even talking about the time it took to write the whole rules and system, but you went public with it back in February. So that's seven months ago, to start building this, start building the conversation, because start building on social media, approach the right kind of people, Now you're getting onto shows and podcasts. Like how many shows and podcasts are you recording?
Jeez, I have something coming up with like nerdarchy.com that I mentioned, and then the RPG Academy. Yeah. They're a pretty popular podcast. They were nominated for an Annie at Gen Con or whatever this year.
Cool. Did you make it over to Gen Con? Sorry,
I did not. I am a person that is a little bit nervous about crowds that are that size. So I will do it because it's something that you need to do from a marketing perspective. I'll do it next year. But since I did not have a physical product yet, I did not want to spend that much money going there this year. I'll be there for sure in August of 2017 or whatever. Yeah. But to answer the question about shows. Yeah. I was on Saving Throw Show, which is a Twitch stream. I was on there just a couple days ago or something. I'm trying to think. There's a Delve podcast. There's a Modifier podcast with Meg. She was an awesome host. If you go to So for those who are interested in where I've been, there's actually a place to find it. We have a community.openlegendrpg.com is a community place where people can find other people who are playing the game, ask questions, interact with each other. And there's a category on there. It kind of behaves a little bit like Facebook, except it's private, a lot less noise and that sort of thing. And there's a press category on there. So you can see.
I'll link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah. You'll see all of my past appearances on podcasts and and Twitch shows and stuff like that there.
All right. And so all the special content and the different settings that we're talking about that are going to be like written by Ed Greenwood and John Wick, would they be placed as kind of stretch goals? Is that the idea or?
Yeah, the idea is I have a commitment from them, and what we'll probably do is in the Kickstarter campaign, we'll see because I really want to deliver that content. I don't want it to be a theoretical thing.
Right.
What they'll do is it'll kind of be like they'll be like very low stretch goals in the sense that once we get the minimum funding, we'll sort of say that I'm willing to invest and lose some of my own money on the project.
Yeah.
So essentially some of these lower tier stretch goals will like sort of lock in, these folks. But realistically, this is a secret that I shouldn't tell, but this is hopefully not too many people hear me promise this on the Kickstarter, but promise this on this recorded podcast. It'll be in there regardless, to be honest. But I'd like to represent recouping a lot of the money, some of the money that I've spent, will be like some of the lower stretch goals. And then we'll have one thing I'm excited about from a marketing for anyone who's a gamer out there. I think that Matt Mercer's fans will bring an interest in like D&D to the table.
Yeah.
So actually a high stretch goal, and this is not guaranteed, but right now in my head, I'm playing with the number of something like 50,000 or something like that. Would be to make the Amorius Dawn campaign setting available for 5th edition. So that's something that I'm planning to do. I already have most of the content. I just need to, kind of write the 5th edition rules and
Very
stuff
cool.
like that.
For Very it, cool. So. And another thing that I usually hear, and I really, you might have come across this because you probably did some studying on preparing for campaigns, it's usually said that a lot of the funding comes like at the very beginning at the launch, and then it kind of dips, slows down, and then at the very end. So one of the difficult things is to either wait or plan some activities for that middle bit where things are slow. So I don't know, are you doing that as well, or like putting as much as possible on the launch or?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do not have a clear plan of action for that right now. I wish that I did. That's one area where, I don't know. You're making me think about it. Maybe I'll change some published dates for some content or something. But right now it's set to kind of all launch at the beginning.
I'm sure it's a tough call between like putting everything in one go and anyhow, it's interesting.
It's tough. I mean,
you have to make choices and go ahead anyway at some point.
Yeah. It's a challenge. Kickstarter is something that, you know, I should give credit as well. BJ Hensley is, she's done a lot of Kickstarters, and she's actually helping in terms of like marketing management and stuff like that. Okay. So she's given advice on some of this stuff. And, so we'll see, what happens, okay. But, you know, at this point, I don't have my strategy is a little bit more simple to just kind of get the word out there early cool. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
We'll see what happens. I'm hopeful that maybe, I don't know. This is not at all guaranteed, but you know, with Matt Mercer on board, I'm hopeful that might be able to open some doors with, maybe having Geek and Sundry, talk about it or something. And that actually, that probably would be a good idea to have that, you know, almost post launch that might be a good fit for what you said, you know, sort of a middle of the road, that slump in the middle as a way to boost it, you know.
If there was a chance to do that. Before we move on to the last part of the conversation, is there anything else that the people listening should know about the Kickstarter and anything else about the components or Open Legend as a project? Or
no, I can't. The only other thing that I would say about it is just, and I think it's obvious, like I said before, my goal is for people to play the game. So yeah. it's very different from a lot of Kickstarters where, you know, you get a lot of pretty images. And I'll say this, I have some amazing illustrators on my team, and I already have lots of illustration that's just incredible. Yeah. We'll be seeing that as we get closer to the campaign. Play the game, I guess is what I would say, which is that it's not like others where you get a lot of promise of, hey, here is this theoretical idea that we're going to build, and you know, hopefully it gets delivered on time and everything. In this case, we are still working on stuff. It's not all finished, but it's very much finished. And the goal for the Kickstarter is to, get people aware of the game and find out like, hey, this is this free game. You can go and play it right now. As you're listening to this, there's nothing preventing you. And so it doesn't have to be a thing that's speculative, right? Yeah. Do I like the game? Is it interesting? My hope is that people love it. And, I think that they will. And, great. You know, try it for yourself, I guess is my thing. And then, and then the Kickstarter is just a way of, I believe a way of establishing a user base, because if you don't, my personal opinion, just from a business perspective, I don't want it to be, you know, oh, this big Kickstarter, and then it's like a one-time delivery and there's no support. I have plans for lots and lots of story content to add to the game. And so the goal is to get the book, you know, get the core rule book and hopefully the campaign setting too, but in as many hands as possible. And then, every person that buys in, that's more people that you're more likely to run into other Open Legend players. So, that's kind of my thought anyway.
Excellent. All right. So we usually finish these kind of conversations with, because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast, what we're calling the cool down questions. And there's always some kind of ice cream related questions. So, I mean, let's start with the easy one. Do you have a favorite flavor?
Favorite flavor. That is a good question. I think, it's interesting. I really like green tea ice cream.
Yeah.
And then I had it at a Japanese restaurant, and it probably was more traditional. Uh-huh. And it was a little bit less sweet than I prefer.
Yeah, but the Japanese kind are not so sweet and a little bit bitter.
Yeah, exactly. So that was, I like it a little bit sweeter. But I am a person who, I don't like sweets very much. So it appeals to me for that reason. So that's cool.
Right. Cool. Green tea. And, usually ask a few questions around, you know, technology and marketing and advertising. And I was wondering, if you, also because you program and develop, and we talked a little bit about technology, have you seen anything in terms of communications or advertising that you thought was a pretty smart use of technology?
Interesting.
Or was using technology in some kind of smart fashion? I don't know if this is where I never know how to ask these kinds of questions. These are the bad questions, because you could say no.
No, I mean, That's my day job, actually. Yeah. I do. So my day job is I am a software architect from a user interface perspective. So I work with the UI UX of a platform.
Yeah.
And, this is actually relevant because we're talking to people that are in advertising and marketing. So we're in a kind of digital signage space. Yes. from an industry perspective. And so we've built this platform that, historically digital signage is very, it involves a lot of the IT department setting things up. But the platform I work on is real cool because it's all just cloud based. So it's all in it's all just HTML based and in the cloud. And so, we work with real cool technology like beacons, for example. I wrote,
that's super interesting.
Yeah, I wrote a little app. It's just an example app, web app that, you walk into a store, you can place an order for your, Starbucks or whatever, and we're not actually endorsing or associated with them, just to be clear, since this is recorded, but, you can order your cappuccino ahead of time. And then when you walk into the store, your phone senses the proximity of the beacon, and then that triggers, that order to go to the barista's queue where they see, orders that are in queue to be made or something like that.
Really interesting kinds of technology on that side of things.
Yeah. So that's what I do with my day job. So we have lots of, we have another idea, they call it lift and learn, where you have little RFID tags on different shoes and you pick up one shoe and then this, in a retail setting, this sign that's in front of you will change and display, informational content about that particular item or whatever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I might as well give a shout out to it's goexp.io. That's our company.
Okay.
That's my platform that I'm the, lead on in terms of user interface, and we do lots of cool stuff. So,
I'll check it out, and I'll add the link to the show notes as well. And actually you made me think of a question that I had in mind, and you might be a very good person to answer that with your background, and particularly working on UX and design background. So I've been thinking, particularly since, a lot of the role playing games, and because role playing games are essentially, mostly books. And and I've always loved and like a lot of other people that are role-playing games, like the object of the book, because it's kind of a bit of a collector thing and it's nice to have. But we've all moved to PDFs, and we've got DriveThruRPG, and even all the Kickstarters that we back, we get the PDFs. Yep. But all the PDFs are still designed and laid out in the same exact way that you'd be reading a large format book, which you need to either be reading mostly on the computer or on your tablet. One of the traditional layouts of that is to have two or three columns. I was talking about it with a friend of mine on another podcast talking about role-playing games. And I was like, I think there's really some evolution in design to be approached for what a role-playing game book should be, how it should be designed and laid out, either for a tablet or a screen in general, or something else.
Absolutely.
Just the simple, usually, I don't like reading on my tablet too much, but that's the only reason I do is for a role-playing game. And it's even just like scrolling down, then back up and across because you have to read the second column. So any thoughts about that? Like where should it go from here, and how could they be designed differently?
Well, hopefully I get a seal of approval from you. If you go to Open Legend RPG's website, we do have a single column designed for that reason.
Yes. I noticed that.
So, just to reiterate, the website, the rules will always be free on the website. It's not just a temporary public beta, you can check out the website I think we should go the single column direction. I'm not sure in terms of my time commitment and resources, and just it takes a lot of time and energy. But I actually have I have a top secret little recipe of code that actually generates my PDF. So I'm actually not doing it in InDesign. I'm actually doing my PDF layout with a special markup language in Markdown. And then I just have special little code commands that change the background of the page and, add images and different stuff like that. But my hope is it does offer the ability to output as HTML, which I can put on the website, as a PDF, which I can put on DriveThruRPG, and there's also a thing for EPUB. So we'll see. Like, I'm not 100% on that, but I'd like to try to put out an EPUB. It's something that's on my radar as like a maybe if people really love it, and maybe you could give me a better idea of how the market feels about it. But maybe it could be like a stretch goal where I'll promise to deliver an EPUB version of the rules or something like that.
I know
that
I would. I mean, this is just like, you know, a sample of one.
Yeah,
I like EPUBs, and I know that there's not many of them, but I do like it. Simple reason: yeah. I use a Kindle, and it's really practical. So if you have a reader, it's really practical. It's really great for carrying and for reading the content. It's not so great for if you're playing and need to refer back to stuff.
Right.
But then again, if you have the EPUB and a PDF, you know, when you're playing, usually, I mean, like most people these days, you have a laptop from which you're referring to things. So that's practical. And, you know, if I'm reading the book for the first time, then going through it from A to Z rather than referencing chapter to chapter, or you could still do chapter to chapter. And yeah, I would read an EPUB and I would appreciate the scratch call. So that's.
Okay. Well, I will count that as one out of one, 100% of people that I've asked votes for EPUB. No, yeah, but I think that's true. Another thing I'll say about that, just while we're talking about it, another enhancement that I want to do on the website is I plan to make it so that you can visit the Open Legend website and then have it be accessible even when your phone is offline. So you can like turn Wi-Fi off on your phone, but you can still, so if you go into a convention where you can't get internet access, you'll still be able to use your phone to reference the Open Legend rules because it's stored locally in the browser of your phone on a permanent basis. Like you can refresh the browser and it's still there. That's the kind of thing, you know, that's one of those cool things I do at my day job. So, something
brilliant.
We'll have to see how it goes. I'm looking forward to it.
I hope it all works out. I mean, obviously I hope you have a really successful crowdfunding project. Can find everything on openlegendrpg.com. .com. Yes,
.com.
Obviously it's going to be on Kickstarter. Is there anywhere else that people should be looking at that they could follow you or follow the game or any last things to add?
Yeah, I mean, just the other two spots are one was mentioned before. You can go to the community website if you want to connect with other players.
Yeah.
community.openlegendrpg.com. And then there's also let's see. There's also Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter. So if you ever have questions for me, you can usually reach me directly on Twitter. And then I also, you can find the Facebook page, facebook.com/openlegendrpg. So those are my main social presences right now. One of my good friends and sort of intern Sydney is, doing Instagram. So we are also on Instagram and you can find us there too.
Brilliant. So. Excellent. Well, listen, Brian, thank you very much. The project sounds very exciting. All the different settings sound very exciting too. So I'm looking forward to checking it out. Launch from the 18th of October, right?
Yeah, 18th of October.
And it's going to be running for about a month, I guess.
Yeah, it'll finish the Saturday before Thanksgiving.
Before Thanksgiving. Okay, cool. Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining the show and have a great day. Bye.
Thanks.
All right, another episode gone. That was brilliant. I hope you really enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did with Brian. I hope you're already checking out the Kickstarter project. I'm certainly checking out the Kickstarter project. I have a big problem because I've been ordering way too many role-playing games on Kickstarter, and I have a backlog of fascinating things to read, but I have a bit of an addiction. I mean, and as much as I can, I love supporting these kinds of creative projects. I love gaming. I love these kinds of stories. So as much as possible, I do a minimum to support these projects on Kickstarter when they're of interest. And I think that's about it for now. As I said, don't hesitate leaving comments or sending an email. All the information is on my website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Again, icecreamforeveryone.net. You can also find Ice Cream for Everyone on Facebook. You can like the page on Facebook. Please share this episode with friends of yours. If you're still listening by now, I hope you enjoyed it enough to share it with a friend. just post it on social media, post it on Facebook. I just want more people to be listening to the show, essentially. So that's about it. And that's about it for now. I'll be back soon for more episodes of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. Have a fantastic evening, morning, lunchtime, afternoon, whatever time it is for you. And see you soon. Bye.